Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross, and here is Rachel Bell, who I think it's fair to say has a dream job, but not as dreamy as this person you talked to.
Oh, such a dreamy job. So there's a woman named Jada Yuan, and out of 13,000 people, she was selected to go around the world and travel on the New York Times dime. So every year they do this feature. It is 52 places that you need to go in. 2018 was last year. And they pick places. I mean, it's like all over the place. Like last year on the list of places that they recommend you go, it's everything from Tasmania and a national park in Zambia to Cincinnati, Ohio. Branson, Missouri. And Seattle actually made the list. And so they chose these places for whatever reasons that they chose them, having to do with like probably cool things going on or safety or political unturmoil at the time. And so for the first time last year, they chose a person to go to all 52 places in a year. And so, of course, 52 weeks in a year, this woman was on an insane travel schedule. So she wasn't just doing one place per week. Sometimes she was somewhere for 2 days. Sometimes she was somewhere for 10 days. She also had to document her journey and write a piece for the New York Times for everywhere she went. So if you think about traveling to 52 places and also working while you're doing it. And she was a writer for the New York Magazine for many years. So they obviously picked someone who is used to writing. In the article that she wrote wrapping up her year, she said that it helps to figure out what your traveling superpower is. And she figured out hers.
I can fall asleep anywhere, anytime. And it's really important. I didn't really realize how many travelers suffer from sleep deprivation. When I was in Tangier, Morocco, we were right next to a mosque that would do a prayer call at 4 a.m. on a loudspeaker right outside our window. And my friends were complaining about it just because they got woken up at 4 a.m. and it would go on for an hour and then they couldn't get back to sleep. I was like, what prayer call? I hadn't heard it.
And she thinks the fact she could nap and sleep on trains was why she didn't get
sick. I didn't think
that
falling asleep anywhere, anytime was a superpower. I thought that was narcolepsy.
Well, yeah, she found she also has a medical condition. It was kind of a twofer. She said she's originally from New Mexico, so the places that were most appealing to her were very verdant and green and lush.
I love going to Chile, Patagonian Chile, which has tropical foliage and mountains and ocean. It was just had everything and beautiful hiking and wonderful people. Bhutan was just one of the most spectacular landscapes I've ever seen. And they very tightly regulate their tourism. And so you're seeing a lot of this nature in its pristine state. Bhutan is carbon negative. It's the only country in the world that's carbon negative and is 70% forest. It's like nothing I'd ever seen. It was so beautiful.
And so she was by herself. There were a couple of times where she had friends visiting her, but she found it was actually too hard to travel with her friends because she had obligations to write. But she does address solo traveling because I think a lot of people are afraid to go on a trip by themselves, especially a woman. She turned 40 during this trip, but found that people are just nice.
Being solo makes you vulnerable. It's scary, but that vulnerability also opens you up to people wanting to help you. By being on my own, I was able to form all these really great connections with people I might not have talked to if I'd had a friend with me and we'd been able to sort of figure out the directions on our own. I continually had to go up to strangers and say, like, so how do you get to this place? Or what restaurant do you like? Working that muscle made me more trusting because over and over and over again, I was proven that people mostly are just nice and are willing to take huge amounts of time out of their lives to help a stranger who's got a few bags and needs to get somewhere.
Well, the best trips I can remember taking were when I had to fly into a place without a reservation, without any plans, and I had to ask, for example, the clerk at a hotel was explaining to me, I'm sorry, we have no rooms. And as I was about to turn away, he says, but I have a friend who has a spare bedroom, and if you want, and you think, well, let's see, am I going to be kidnapped? But, you know, it turns out, no, he just had a friend who had a bedroom, and it was the best because, you know, it was a young guy, and then mother served breakfast the next day, and you got the feel of what it was like to live there.
Yeah, I've had the same experiences, and then I come back to the States, and I say, now I'm going to be that person, and I'm going to be welcoming, and I'm not. It kind of fades away.
It is.
But I think a lot of people tell me, because, you know, I feel like a language barrier doesn't discourage me from going anywhere. I've traveled many places. You just figure it out. And so I feel like, you know, listening to her, I hope it motivates people to go places that are out of their safe zone. And when I say safe zone, I don't mean, you know, a war-torn country, but right. just someplace that you're like, ooh, it sounds scary to me because I don't speak the language, or, you know, it's a poor country. It's a first world country. It's not as hard as you think it is.
Right. Rachel Bell. Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you so much.
Let's get an update on what may or may not happen today to end the partial government shutdown. CBS's Stephen Portnoy joins us from the White House.
The latest word this morning is that things are fluid. What that indicates is that Mitch McConnell doesn't necessarily have the 60 votes he would need to get onto the bill or unanimous consent to even have that vote today. Democrats could object, and that could, you know, lengthen this process. But the bottom line is, without 60 votes, this 1,300-page package that dropped late last night here in D.C. is not going to pass the Senate. It's certainly not going to pass the House, where Democratic leaders have no intention of bringing it to the floor. So what we have is the package that the president proposed on Saturday being turned into legislative text. It would fully fund the government agencies that have been closed for the last 32 days. It would extend in legislative terms the DACA protections for 3 years, the TPS, that's for people who came to this country legally from disaster-stricken countries but have a limited time to stay here legally for 3 more years. But the bottom line is Democrats say it's not acceptable to them. The president this morning tweets that Democrats had better start taking the wall seriously. And essentially, the bottom line is the most important phrase of his tweet ends with the following two words. No cave! Exclamation point. The president's position is firm and clear. He's not going to cave, as he puts it. Democrats feel just as strongly. There's no real change here in Washington, D.C.
The Democrats have taken the position that we are not going to reward the president for this shutdown. What exactly does that mean? Are they looking for a piece of legislation that would prevent any future shutdown? Are they looking for capitulation of the president's base, you know, make things so miserable that they start turning on the president? What exactly are the Democrats looking for?
The two sides, Dave, are talking directly past each other. Nancy Pelosi just tweeted that this week the House Democrats will vote on more bipartisan bills, as she calls them, to reopen the government. Essentially, they are clean bills that address only the funding questions and don't take on this wall question. The Republicans have been asked, well, why don't you agree to that? If you agree on the funding levels for all these other agencies, including Homeland Security, absent the wall money, why not meet Democrats where they are? And their position is, well, the president has signaled he opposes that, and so therefore we shouldn't even waste our time on something the president won't sign, which leads conservative Bill Kristol to raise the point on Twitter that in our system, according to the Article 1 of the Constitution, it's the Congress that disposes of, to use a strange phrase, of legislation. So the president, in his mind, should be able and willing to accept whatever the Congress decides it wants. And in this case, the Congress has not decided, because many members of the Senate Republican caucus say that they will stand in opposition alongside the president to anything that he signals his opposition to. The bottom line, Dave, as has been the case for the last month, if President Trump were to turn around and say, okay, fellas, vote for this without wall funding, it would pass and the government would reopen. That's the point the Democrats have been making. However, the president's position is firm, and it's clear. He wants wall funding. That's where we are. It's where we've been.
Okay, so let me just be clear about this. You're saying, so it would be fair to say, if I'm arguing this in the carpool on the way to work this morning, it is fair to say that a bill to open the government could pass both houses of Congress. The only thing holding it up is a presidential signature.
What we saw before Christmas was the Senate on a nearly unanimous basis passing bipartisan legislation that would have avoided the shutdown. It didn't have any wall money. It would have extended Homeland Security funding through, I think, February 8th. So it would have been at least through this period. And that's what Democrats say the Senate should again take up. What changed? President Trump, at the last minute, said, never mind, I'm out of the deal. And so, therefore, Democrats are making this argument, and they have been making this argument for weeks, that it's the decision of one man to oppose anything that doesn't include wall funding, even though the Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell and his colleagues were okay with that a month ago.
CBS White House correspondent Stephen Portnoy. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Join us now into the mysterious world of computer security and white hat hacking. It's the subject of a new book called Breaking and Entering by Jeremy Smith. And it's about a hacker who goes by the name Alien and doesn't really fit what your stereotype image of a hacker may be. Describe Alien for us, would you?
Well, when I met Alien, it was at a preschool play date. Our daughters were playing together, and she was asking what I did. I said, I'm a writer. I said, what do you do? And she said, well, tomorrow morning, I have to break into a bank. There was a station wagon, baby wipes, frozen dolls, and, you know, the sort of real-life equivalent of the girl with the dragon tattoo.
Right. And so you decided this would make a great book. But tell me what makes her story important.
Well, I think there's a lot of missing pieces to our image of hackers and hacking. I think all of us today realize we're being targeted by hackers, and our institutions we rely on are as well. But we don't realize that some hackers can work to improve security, such as Alien and her team. We don't realize that hackers, like hacking, have grown up and are now adults with families, and that they are professional, for better or for worse, on both sides. Both the good guys and the bad guys are pros now. These aren't amateurs in a basement or teenagers with a hoodie playing around for fun anymore.
Do you feel more secure after writing this book or less secure?
I guess I feel more informed, and knowledge is power, but I'm much more acutely aware of how data is forever. Anything that I'm tracked ever is out there forever and can be linked. And I'm also much more aware of how the institutions I rely on can be broken into, because I followed in her footsteps, talked to her and her colleagues about their real-life adventures and experiences breaking into them. And that's what she does on a daily basis.
Right. And if the good guys can do it, the bad guys can do it. Okay, we happen to have opened a secret, encrypted, high-security phone line to Alien herself. Alien, I'm going to ask you the same question I asked Jeremy, your biographer here. Being in the business you are, do you feel more secure or less secure for us being now totally dependent on computer technology?
Well, first of all, good morning, and it's a pleasure to be here. You know, I've been in this industry for so long that I think it's just sort of part of my everyday consciousness not to trust computers, not to trust the systems we rely on. I mean, part of Jeremy's book is me being in the hospital in labor and realizing that their systems were out of date and could potentially have a computer virus infection. So I think when you're in this industry, it just sort of permeates your everyday conscious, and you do feel vulnerable, but you learn to accept that risk as part of your everyday life.
So when you are called upon to investigate some kind of hack, how do you begin?
Well, it depends on exactly what type of case it is. You know, we've been seeing epidemics this past year of ransomware and also banking trojans. And with a ransomware case, you might have a whole city that's been shut down. And so your first goal is, number one, to get things back up and running, and then also to preserve evidence that would allow you to hopefully rule out or at least narrow down a data breach. Whereas if it's a banking trojan, the focus may not be so much on operations as stopping the bleeding of data. So it really just depends a little bit on the type of case.
See, Jeremy, this is the kind of thing that makes me feel insecure. The fact that it is even possible now for someone to shut an entire city down or to go into somebody's bank account and drain it.
Well, I don't worry too much about my banking information, especially on a personal level, because you're FDIC insured, and, you know, bank account numbers are something that can be changed. Things like medical information or your emails, that's something that I would worry about a lot more.
What are the motives of the bad guys, Alien? Is it always money, or is a lot of it just bragging rights?
I think a lot of it is money. A lot of it is certainly financially motivated. And remember, the hackers that break into your computers may not be the ones that are ultimately leveraging the information. So the hackers that break in might want to just gather up everything that's valuable and resell it on the black market. And you might have people buying that information that are looking to extort money from people that have political motives. They're trying to affect change in our society. Certainly a lot of it is financially motivated. Some of it is nation state funded. But you're talking about the broader hacking economy, where they're just stealing your data and then reselling it on the black market to people that are going to use it for other purposes.
That ransomware stuff is particularly insidious, where unbeknownst to you, some virus is loaded on your computer and you get a message saying, well, your data's been locked away, but we'll give it back to you for, you know, $500. When that happens, are you better off paying the money, or can you call somebody like you and have those guys frog marched to prison?
Well, the answer, of course, is something in between. Generally speaking, we don't want to fund terrorist groups, and we don't want to fund these criminals. So if there's a way around it, you want to find that way around it. So take good backups and make sure that those backups aren't writable, so that if your computer does get infected with a virus, it can't overwrite your backups as well. That's the best thing to do, is take that preventative measure. I worry a lot more about what's going to happen when our smart homes come online a lot more, when your power systems in your house, your refrigerators, everything like that is controlled by computers, because then criminals can come in and hold and say, hey, I'm going to turn off your power and hold you for ransom, and your house won't be able to operate until you pay that money.
That's the other thing. Why are we even considered doing that? I understand that I have no option in terms of, well, for example, filing news stories. They would do it all by computer. I got reason for that. But I can go out and push the garage door button by myself. I can operate the thermostat by myself, and I can certainly operate the refrigerator by myself. At some point, don't you say, maybe this isn't a good idea to even go down the road of automating everything?
I think that's a personal choice. My recommendation would be, I don't think we want to stand in the way of progress. Let's leverage technology as best we can. But also, we have to keep security in mind as we go along. And we've kind of leapfrogged a lot of security over the past 20 years, and now we're kind of going back and putting Band-Aids on. You know, we've had the tools needed to provide a much higher level of security now for 20 years or more. And we have, as a society, chosen, we've made the choice to systematically not deploy those or dismantle them. Hmm. For example, there are tools that could very easily allow you to properly encrypt your email, and they could be made very easy to use. But we have chosen not to do that because businesses want to scan your email. Our government wants to read your email. And so these security tools have been left out on purpose. And that is a choice that we have made. And because of that, we are much less secure than we would be otherwise.
That's not a choice I made, but you're right. The whole reason that you get email for free and you get Facebook for free is so they can scan your content and sell you stuff. So obviously, if you encrypt it, they can't do that. Now, aren't there, though, private encryption programs that you could download to circumvent that?
There are, and as Jeremy can attest to, we've been using those, but they're not as user-friendly as they could be. For example, there could be a button built into Microsoft's email products that just says, get the other person's key or send an encrypted email. Like, literally, you could have it be automatic, but it's not that way. And the reason it's not that way is because so many businesses and our governments want to be able to monitor your email.
So do you think that ought to be made a requirement, that we pass a rule that says that must be an option if you want to sell software in the United States?
I think no one is secure unless everyone is secure, and I hope that at some point we can learn to do that.
It's an interesting book. It's called Breaking and Entering, The Extraordinary Story of a Hacker Called Alien by Jeremy Smith. Jeremy, thank you. And Alien, thank you.
Thank you, Dave.
Thank you very much.
No one is secure unless everyone's secure, which is just an elegant way of saying no one's secure.
Time for your daily dose of kindness. There's been a lot of talk about how we raise boys, hasn't there? Gillette, for some reason, kicked a hornet's nest when they asked men to be the best they can be. Well, CBS's Steve Futterman met one young man who is living that motto.
Get a piece of him! Get a piece of him!
As a state champion wrestler, Merrick Bush has very few real competitors. But the sophomore from Central Valley Academy near Utica, New York, does have at least one rival, a junior from Indian River named Logan Patterson. Merrick met him on the mat earlier this month.
I practiced hard that entire week, and I wanted to beat him.
Terry Kavanaugh was the referee.
I've been in sports a long time, and I've never seen anything like it.
As expected, it was a great match. Until, with just about 30 seconds left, Logan twisted his elbow.
Oh, my God!
Up to that point, Merrick had been losing. But Logan's arm was now so badly injured, there was almost no way Merrick couldn't win. So he told his coach, I got this, and went back in to do what he says he had to do.
Again, all he had to do was stand up and pin his hobbled opponent. But instead, Merrick did nothing. He just told Logan he was sorry about his arm and surrendered. Logan couldn't believe it.
He just sat there. He didn't move. You think it was goodness out of his heart. He's a great person. I know it makes me look kind of like a weakling, but...
No.
That's all right.
No, it doesn't.
No, he's no weakling at all. I mean, state championships come and go, but that, you can't take that away from a kid.
The crowd watched on their feet and through blurry eyes as Merrick lost the tournament but won the admiration of everyone in the gym. Most especially.
Rob. Yeah.
His dad.
Yep.
Bob.
I'm very proud. It's not about winning all the time. It's about doing what's right. And he did.
More importantly, Merrick thought doing the right thing would make him look like a weakling. But he did it anyway. Now that's a powerful kid. Steve Hartman, on the road, near Utica, New York.
Yes, as you heard, Steve Hartman. Forgive me, news gods. Steve Futterman's a fine reporter himself. But this was Steve Hartman, who has just a special way of telling stories.
He does. Time for our Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. Here he is, Danny O'Neill. Danny, Colleen found this interview.
That's right. I was just fishing around for Edgar News this morning, and on MLB.com, Harold Reynolds was talking to Edgar on the eve of his possible Hall of Fame induction, and he talks about vision problems that I did not know he had to this day and what he did to fix them. And so this is what he talked about with his condition called strabismus that keeps his eyes from working together properly.
So I have to kind of make those muscles stronger.
You're trying to hit tennis balls,
mm-hmm.
and call out the number on the tennis balls coming at you like 85, 90 miles an hour.
The tennis ball will come out about 130 miles an hour.
Excuse me?
I'll hold the bat here, and I will try to track it as far as I could until he hit.
That was surprising. I just love him. I want to give him a hug today in a very motherly way because he's just such a delightful guy. But to overcome your eyes not being able to work together and be so successful as a professional athlete and then continue to work on it into, you know, his coaching and mentor career, I find that really amazing.
It is amazing. There was nothing sure about Edgar Martinez's career. Not from when he was a prospect at 20 years old and reporting to Bellingham. And certainly not that the eye condition, I believe it came out in March 1999. He was losing vision of pitches. And he was diagnosed with this condition. His right eye would drift. And it would cause his eyes to not align properly. And he'd lose depth perception. Which you can imagine how important that would be for someone trying to hit a moving object that's coming at you at 100 miles an hour.
And he has been hit in the head before, and he addresses that in this interview with MLB.com. I'm not sure if it was because his eye issue was starting to affect him, but they show one of those hits to the head, and it's just brutal.
Yeah, he did get hit, and I think eventually there's even one point where Edgar charged the mound. And I assume that he charged the mound quite slowly because he was never the swiftest Mariner.
Right.
But he did the exercises with the tennis balls. He also would have charts that he would use to try and force his right eye to focus, to try and train the muscles to overcome the condition. And 1999 is when the condition emerged, and he had many productive years. Today's the announcement of the Hall of Fame induction. 3:00 is when the votes are announced. We all expect Edgar to be among, and it might be four people that are included in this class in the Hall of Fame. We're expecting him to get in. It's a really remarkable accomplishment. I was thinking it on the way down here. He might be the greatest Seattle athlete who went start to finish in Seattle, never played anywhere else. Because there have been incredible athletes. There's no doubt about that. Walter Jones is probably the guy that would be closest, and Walter was probably a better player in his discipline, but he's an offensive lineman, doesn't have stats.
Yeah.
And he's been in the Hall of Fame, and Cortez Kennedy was there. Steve Largent would have been on that list, but Largent was acquired. He played a year elsewhere before coming here. Edgar was our own, and I think that he is the best. He'll be the second player to be inducted as a Mariner. Ken Griffey Jr. was also inducted as a Mariner, but Ken had played a couple different spots before he came back.
So do you think Edgar should get a statue like Ken did?
Yeah, I do.
Well, he's
got,
sure.
He's got Edgar 100%. Martinez Drive. Would you rather have a statue or a drive?
Both.
Yeah, well, I think a statue.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, a very small statue, Dave.
Yeah, because they can correct all the flaws.
A very diminutive statue?
Yeah. Or, you know, statues sometimes.
More like a figurine.
Statues sometimes don't work out.
Statues are awesome. Like
I mean,
a statue.
They're awesome, but sometimes you look at them and it looks like they kind of smoosh the face a little bit. I mean...
Yeah, but how great is it to have a traffic jam on your street? We've got a four-mile backup on Edgar Martinez Way. You're like, hey, I got nothing to do with that.
That's true.
Well,
guilty
still,
by association
that,
with it.
It's not that long, Danny.
No.
Just seeing his name calms me in a traffic jam.
It's very, very cool.
Tell us briefly about who the Mariners are sending to the Yankees now and... Are we going to regret this?
Josh Stowers is an outfielder that's going there. I don't think we're going to regret it because we're not getting the guy back from the Yankees. We've injected ourselves into a trade. We've made ourselves part of, the Mariners have made themselves part of the Reds-Yankees deal for Sonny Gray. We're getting a guy named Shed. Shed Long.
Okay.
And so. Shed Long, ironically, is quite short. He's 5'8". He's a left-handed power hitter. He's a second baseman.
Good.
Yeah.
Fireplug, huh?
I'm pumped. Yeah, he's going to get up there. There's a clip on, I believe it's on Facebook, of him at a Reds Fest where he's just cranking out wiffle ball home runs with
great.
One arm.
You know
it's
me,
awesome.
I love seeing short guys excel.
Yeah, it's going to be fantastic.
It surprises you. You don't think they can do it. And then Jax went out the center field.
This was encouraging for this reason. Shed Long is closer to the majors than Josh Stowers is. Stowers was their second-round pick last year and a guy with pretty good profile. Like he projects as a pretty good player. He's further away from the majors. Acquiring Shed Long increases that likelihood and the fact that they're pointing toward being good next year or the year after.
Excellent. Thank you, Danny.
You bet. Talk to you soon.
Go, Edgar.
Sports Insider brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. We go live to New York City. Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter David Farenthold joins us from the Washington Post. David, it looks like the Senate is going to take up that compromise legislation the president proposed over the weekend. What is likely to happen?
I think it's possible it'll pass the Republican-led Senate, but it will go nowhere. I don't think it really is going to be the vehicle for compromise. I don't think the Democrats in the House will agree to it. They've rejected, I think, a lot of the parts that are most Democrat-friendly in it. The one possibility is this signals the opening of actual negotiations that might lead to a deal that would pass.
I thought that now the Democrats are actually going to negotiate. I thought their position was you open the government first, then we'll negotiate.
That is their position. It continues to be, you know, Trump's position is, in theory, you know, I want the wall and maybe with, you know, I'll give you this little bit of thing. I don't think either one of them are making serious offers now, but, you know, I think everybody wants to end this. We're now passing the second pay period that their federal employees wouldn't be paid. Absenteeism is going up among TSA agents at airports. The pain is affecting a lot of people. I think everybody would like to end this, but not in a way that gives them less leverage for next time.
Well, does everybody want to end this? And my impression is, I mean, like you say, we're going to miss the second paycheck. TSA delays are beginning to show up, even here at SeaTac now. Do Democrats really want to delay this, or do they want to see capitulation by Trump's base before they do?
I think they're happy to have this go on a little bit longer because it seems like it's bleeding Trump support. Voters are increasingly blaming Trump for the shutdown. But, you know, the Democrats, you know, this is a broad stereotype, but they like government. They want government to work. They think government has a role in our lives.
Yeah.
And if you do this long enough that government, key government employees start quitting rather than having to work indefinitely for free, then, you know, there's a cost to them, too. This isn't costless to them.
All right. The BuzzFeed story on Michael Cohen, who now claims apparently that it was the president who told him to lie about this whole Trump Tower negotiation. And then the special counsel issuing what I believe to be an unprecedented denial, saying BuzzFeed got it wrong, although it was very carefully worded. What do you get from that?
Well, it seems like there was something in the BuzzFeed story that was wrong, and that's really, really important. It's really bad. This was a story that sort of led people to start talking about impeachment in a very serious way. If President Trump directed someone to lie to Congress, that's suborning perjury, and it's the kind of thing Richard Nixon was impeached for. And so people took it really seriously when it came out. The special counsel, as you said, never comments. The fact that they commented to say that pieces of this story were not accurate means that pieces of the story were not accurate. And so I think BuzzFeed owes all of us an explanation about what actually went wrong and what they're still sure about. It does nobody in the media any favors if people make a huge scoop like this and then have to end up in a position of saying, well, most of it's true. We'll get back to you when we figure out what's not true.
Yeah, so you're a little ticked off about this too, then, sounds like.
Yeah, obviously, we, you know, everybody wants to be first, but in a situation like this where there's so much credibility riding on every one of our decisions, you can't be wrong. And you can't be wrong about something like this. And I think BuzzFeed's attitude about it has been pretty cavalier. since the special counsel made this, as you said, first of its kind statement that they're wrong, they've come out and said, well, our sources say we're still right. We're holding firm. You know, I think that there's a need for a little more humility on their part, both before they publish and now.
Yeah. Your own story, your latest story, involves T-Mobile executives involving a Trump-branded property, T-Mobile being headquartered here. Tell me about that.
Well, we got these lists of VIP arrival logs at the Trump Hotel. So these are the lists they give for the employees of the Trump Hotel in D.C. of which VIPs are checking in for that night. And we got one for April 30th of last year. So it's the day after T-Mobile announces this big merger with Sprint that could bring a lot of money, bring a lot of jobs. It's a huge deal to T-Mobile's future. The day after they announce this merger, which needs approval from the Trump administration, 9 T-Mobile executives checked into the Trump Hotel in D.C., and they came back again and again and again. One of them was on his 10th visit just 6 weeks later. We actually found the CEO of T-Mobile, John Ledger, in the Trump Hotel lobby just last week. He was staying there again. So it seems like a concerted effort to bring their business to the Trump Hotel at the same time they need something from the Trump administration.
Seriously? You sure it wasn't just the most conveniently located accommodation they could find?
Well, the funny thing about it is you could tell that they had, from these VIP arrival lists, that most of them had not ever stayed at the Trump Hotel before. It is convenient to the Department of Justice. But the interesting part of this is that Ledger, the T-Mobile CEO, had actually had like a long feud with Trump before Trump won the election, where he said, Trump, your hotel is terrible. I don't like you. He once sort of speculated that maybe Ronda Rousey of the UFC could beat up Donald Trump. So Ledger had this feud with Trump, and then as soon as he needs something from Trump, he is a very, very loyal Trump customer.
So do you think there's really a connection?
I've looked at a lot of these VIP arrivals logs. I've seen a lot of the customers that have come and going. T-Mobile is one of the most loyal customers in that entire period. And it's a really striking difference to what happened apparently before they needed something from Trump.
Huh. John Ledger, I believe, is a pretty active tweeter. Has he said anything about your story?
It's funny. We found him in the lobby of the Trump Hotel last week when he was staying there. The next night he tweeted, I'm at my current hotel, the Four Seasons in Georgetown. He moved to a different hotel and then tweeted about how he was not at the Trump Hotel anymore. And then after the story came out, he came out and said, well, there's been a lot of attention to the hotels I'm staying at, but you know, I don't think it's going to affect the merger at all. I think it's, you know, I don't think this has anything to do. I don't think this will have any influence on the Trump administration.
David Farenthold continuing to shake it up at the Washington Post. Thank you, David.
Thank you.
Are you ready for another gun control debate? Of course you are. Months after voters approved those sweeping new gun safety measures, gun control once again is agenda item number one in Olympia. Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott is here. Boy, I haven't heard about a turnout like this for a public hearing in a long time.
Yeah, thousands, close to 2,000 people showed up for this hearing in a Senate committee yesterday, 1,300 to testify. They didn't all obviously get a chance. There's several proposals. The two that got the most attentions came from Attorney General Bob Ferguson. That includes a ban on so-called high-capacity magazines.
High-capacity magazines do make shootings more deadly for obvious reasons. Those high-capacity magazines, you do not need to stop to reload. They were used in Newtown, Orlando, Las Vegas, Aurora, Parkland. Parkland shooting only came to an end when the shooter had to stop to reload.
That bill puts a 10-round limit on magazines. Existing magazines, though, are grandfathered in, but there are limits on transporting them. There was passionate testimony from both sides at the hearing, including from Amy Strand, whose 15-year-old son Sam was killed in the 2017 Freeman High School shooting near Spokane.
My son missed out on driver's ed. He missed out on homecoming. I never got to see him with his braces off. He missed out on Thanksgiving and Christmas and Easter. He's missed everything since and will miss everything coming. He's not going to get to see his sister graduate from high school or college. He's not going to get to watch his sister get married, nor will he be able to grow up and have his own family. He's going to miss everything, and I have missed everything about him. I think about him every day.
She told the committee it was sheer luck that the shooter who killed her son didn't kill other kids that day.
The shooting happened before class time, so the hallways were full of children. Had his high-capacity magazine rifle not jammed, just imagine the carnage that would have happened at the school that day.
Local Las Vegas shooting survivor Emily Cantrell also urging lawmakers to pass the ban.
People served best by high-capacity magazines are mass shooters. The only reason I'm able to sit here today is the mass shooter who tried to kill me and 22,000 other concertgoers had to stop to reload. This gunman used an arsenal of weapons, 12 of which were AR-15s with 100-round magazines, to shoot more than 500 people in Las Vegas on October 1st, 2017, killing 58 of them. High-capacity magazines paired with a bump stock allowed the shooter to fire 90 shots in 10 seconds. Imagine 1,100 rounds total in 10 minutes coming right at you.
But Tom Kwisiak with the NRA had this point to make.
It's important, I think, to clarify that these magazines are standard capacity magazines that come with typical semi-automatic handguns that people use to defend themselves on a day-to-day basis. They make up over half the magazines owned in the United States. They're not high capacity. They're not uncommon.
And this rape survivor told lawmakers that the proposal puts her at risk.
I also carry a revolver because I will not ever experience that again. 10 rounds, I would not be able to protect myself. I urge you to kill Senate Bill 5062 so that women like me do not have to continue to be afraid and victimized.
The other bill getting a lot of the attention yesterday from the AG bans what he calls ghost guns, untraceable and undetectable guns, often made with a 3D printer. Shoreline teen Nara Kim with the March for Our Lives Seattle movement told lawmakers that those kind of guns put everyone at risk.
Right now, it is possible in Washington for an unlicensed person to build a gun from parts they printed or ordered online, all with no background check, no serial number, and no tracking. Those weapons can't be traced by law enforcement. They make it harder for cops to solve crimes and easier for dangerous people to have access to deadly weapons.
But on the flip side,
undetectable firearms do not exist. Anyone using that term does so in ignorance or to purposely deceive others.
The bills allowing cops to take guns on domestic violence calls if they think a crime has been committed, and new training requirements for concealed pistol licenses were also heard yesterday. And all of those bills again come up in a House committee today, along with other gun proposals.
What is your sense? Is the ban on high-capacity magazines going to pass or not?
I am going to say my sense is that it's got the best chance it's ever had. It's been up multiple times. It's a tough sell. Like the NRA pointed out, these are magazines that most gun owners, half of the people, probably firearms owners in the state, have a handgun with a clip that holds 10 or more. You get to keep yours, so it's not like they're going to come and take theirs away, which I think other states have. I believe New Jersey passed a similar ban, and they have to turn them in. Yeah, you have to turn them in. So you don't have to do that here. So I think because you don't have to give them back here, I think that maybe gives it a chance to go. We'll see. I think it's got a better chance than before.
Thanks, Hannah.
You bet.
Kyra, it is Hannah Scott. Choke Points. Brought to you by Online Trading Academy. It is the second week with no viaduct and no tunnel. So let's get the update. Earlier this morning, you were feeling good?
Yeah, early. And overall, it's not that dissimilar than what we saw the last couple of last days last week. I mean, it looks like most people are sticking with their plan. I did notice a little bit more traffic volume in general, just a little bit more. I'm not sure if I can read anything into that yet, but what I can say for certain today is that West Seattle has had it much worse than it did any of the days last week. Really? And the combination of that was we had an early morning Spokane bridge lift. It happened, in the 5 to 6 a.m. hour, or right in the early 6 o'clock hour. And so that bogged up all the surface streets. And so because of that, and we also have a lot more terminal traffic today at the Port of Seattle. So there's a lot of trucks out there that weren't out there, last week. And because of that, the surface streets have taken a lot more slowing. I heard one person on Twitter say it took him an hour to get from the top of Admiral Way just down to the lower Spokane Street Bridge.
Wow.
So that tells you kind of what they're dealing with today. But everything else looks about the same as last week.
And the connector project is on schedule, so there's no...
They've had the good weather, even with the rain moving in. It's not as weather dependent as some of the other work has, but they are right on schedule, they think, to open in time at the end of 2 weeks now.
And an exciting new project down in Lacey, the first diverging diamond in the state.
Yes, the diverging diamond intersection we've talked about for a while. It's going in at I-5 at Marvin Road. Basically, what it does is it forces you to make a figure eight as you go across the top of the freeway. So as you're approaching the freeway overpass, you would normally go straight, wait at a left turn signal, and make a left onto the freeway. What this does is at the beginning of the overpass, it switches you into the left lane. You drive in the opposite side of to normal traffic, and then you can just take a free left onto the freeway. And at the same time, the on-ramp people are getting on that same ramp. So it moves a lot more people a lot faster. It reduces the amount of accident potential by about 50%, but it's weird. I mean, it's weird to get used to, but it's going in. Construction started on that one in Lacey just recently. It's the first of several going in the area. The next one's going to be on I-90 at 18 there in the Snoqualmie area. These have been going in and be getting rave reviews across the country. They move people more efficiently. They reduce accidents and reduce wait times. So it's going to be interesting. You go to MyNorthwest.com. You can check out the video. I think we should have that up shortly of how this thing works.